Welcome to our second session with Professor Elaine Franz on the history of crime and control in Pittsburgh. Today's topic is policing Pittsburgh 1816 to 1861. Welcome, Elaine.
Didn't press vigorously enough. Hello all, welcome. And welcome to people on Zoom too. I'm glad that you're here and I'm glad that you guys are here. Thank you very much. Yeah, I know that's what we'll be getting to this. I do have a handout that I just, Zoom people, I have a handout that I just gave out to the people who are here, which we'll be getting to a little later. And I'll see if there's some way that I can.
We can post it after the session.
Okay, that would be great. Okay, thanks. It's not really central, but it's really interesting. So, okay. So today what I want to talk about is the second of the four discussions we're going to have about the history of Pittsburgh policing. And this is going to take us from the year 1816 up to the Civil War. And we're going to ask the question, who policed Pittsburgh from 1816 up to the Civil War? And also, who were they policing and what was that like? And this is going to be a huge evolution of policing during this time because Pittsburgh itself changes massively, right? This is the period of Pittsburgh's growth. Pittsburgh begins in 1820. Has around, I think we talked about this at the end of the last session, but Pittsburgh has around 20,000 people, around 7,000 people in 1820, a little over that. But by 1860, it has almost 50,000 people. So it's gonna, it will have, you know, it's nine times as big, right? Something like that by the end of this period as it was at the beginning. So it's gonna be a considerable change. And there's also going to be, and most of that growth is actually going to happen in the 1840s because Pittsburgh.
I think I'm muted.
Am I muted?
No, you're not muted.
Okay, great. Because Pittsburgh prospered during the Mexican War, helping to provide provision, things like that. So the 1840s end up being a very prosperous time for Pittsburgh. And it's going to explode during that time, even though there's a great big fire as well that burns down large part of the city. That's going to be a great period of growth. So basically, the population of Pittsburgh expands dramatically during this time, and policing is going to expand dramatically during this time. Both because Pittsburgh's population expands and because there's a international and national change in how we think about policing during this same period of time. So at the very beginning of this time, just to give you kind of a framework, when we kind of step into this period, you don't have anybody who's being paid a regular salary to police Pittsburgh, okay? So in 1816, the real answer, like who's getting paid to police Pittsburgh, is sort of like no one. So there is a constable. You know, occasionally they might pay the constable a fee to say walk around on every Sunday and make sure that people are orderly, you know, on the streets on Sunday. For instance, they did that. But basically, there's no one. They actually try in 1816. Pittsburgh becomes a city, and they decide that they're going to, a borough, and they decide that they're going to hire a night watch. And it's important to remember that they're much more interested in policing Pittsburgh at night than they are. Oh, could you move the screen forward one? It's not very exciting, but technically this is where we ought to be, this next one. There we go. Thank you. So in 1816, they do decide that they're going to hire some night watchmen. They're much more interested in policing the city at night than during the day, because during this time, so much policing is just done by regular people. Like, you know, so much when you're really counting on staying safe or, you know, having injustices against you resolved, you're counting on your neighbors to step forward to do that, right? So what you really need policing wise, if you're going to pay somebody, is you need people to be available at night when your neighbors are asleep, right? And they can't help. So at first in 1816, they say, well, let's get a night watch. We're gonna hire 8 guys. They're gonna be a night watch, just like they do in Philly. At this point, they already have like this big old night watch in Philly, and you know everything like that. We're like, we're gonna do this too, because now we're a borough. So we hire like 8 people, and then the bill comes due to pay them, and we don't have the money. We don't have the money to pay them, and so we actually end up sort of, you know, somehow scrambling together the money, but then immediately firing them. Like they only serve for just a couple of weeks. We can't afford it. And then also we built them little sheds so that they could stay warm at night ish. You know, they weren't heated or anything, but we built them little places to stand. And we're going to try to rent this out after 1816 to make money. You know, we're like, does anybody want the constable stand? You know, we're trying to, and then that we're actually like, but if you do rent it, we have to keep the stuff in it. Like we're using it for storage as well. Right. So they're really like, we did not have very much money. And then also we had issued them coats when we got these 8 constables. Constables are not constables, these night watchmen. Night watchmen are poor men and they can't afford coats, right? You know, big warm coats, that so you could be out at night. So we actually issued great coats to these 8 watchmen. And when we immediately fired them, we had to ask them for their coats back. And then we actually had to sell the coats. So one of the city council decides to sell the 8 coats again, and, you know, use the money to try to, you know, get the treasury up. So we definitely did not have and the idea of constables, of night watchmen, doesn't come back for a while, right? It's going to be several years before we actually do get those night watchmen that we wanted. So basically at the beginning in 1816, we really don't have anything as far as policing, except for, you know, one guy. One guy who's elected as the constable. But what we do is we start to have a fee system. We say, well, there's some tasks that we need to have done. We can't afford to pay anybody a salary, but we can have a regular guy who sort of does the tasks that need to be done. And maybe he can be kind of on call day and night for whenever there's any problem. And we're going to pick a guy who lives at the hardest to police area in Pittsburgh, which is the marketplace. So we now have our own marketplace. And the marketplace is the place of all disorder. It's a place where the thefts happen, but it's also the place where, you know, any sort of violence, attacks, and just rowdiness happens around the marketplace. It's kind of the central square, right, of Pittsburgh. And so the guy they pick for this is a guy named James Guthrie. He's not related. I was so excited because I thought he might be related to the future mayors named Guthrie, but he's not. He's a different, less fancy Guthrie, right? His lineage does not go on to be mayor. But James Guthrie becomes the sort of go-to constable. He's not elected. The elected constable is different, but the elected constable is kind of doing less and less because he's just kind of an elite guy who's elected. Maybe he'll do a couple things and get, you know, gather a couple fees for things he can get fees for. But they decide they're actually going to appoint this guy, James Guthrie, to sort of be a go-to constable. And he's going to end up doing most of the work of policing for between 1816 and 1825. He seems to be the sort of on the ground police officer. And sometimes they're going to actually have other people too that they pay to do police work, but they're getting paid by fees. So every time he does something, he's like, I had to, you know, stop a fight this night. He then has to come to the next council meeting and ask for $1, you know, for the work that he did. And it turns out that James Guthrie we don't know too much about James Guthrie. We know where he lived. We can find him on the census. We know he had, you know, five kids, you know, lived there with his wife. We know he lived near the marketplace, but we know a little bit more about him than about almost any other police officer because he had enough. He started complaining about his job and about how little he was paid. And he wrote, and he had his neighbors write, and he had some public officials who supported him write on his behalf to the council and say, this guy has to be treated better. It's ridiculous what you're asking him to do. And he actually says, he complains in 1821, after 5 years on the job, he complains about all the work that he had done for, quote, the unchartered gentry of this city, for which menial service several years rendered, I have never, I've never sought nor received a cent. And what he means by that, because he has paid fees for his policing duty, is that the council also asks him to like run their meetings, like incidentally, like since you're getting, you know, these fees, maybe like on the side, you can get us coal for our, you know, to keep our meeting warm, and you can like circulate information for us, and you can, you know, bring us pens and ink and things like that. So he was sort of being asked to be their sort of, you know, servant, so that he could be the one that they give this job of, you know, being the sort of constable. And he's had enough, and he asked for money. And then also his neighbors complain on his behalf, and they say he's, you know, all the time people wake him up at night and tell him to go and address disorders of the marketplace, and he keeps getting beaten up, and, you know, it's a really, really difficult job and you should pay him money. And then the mayor, a previous mayor, comes forward and says, you know, I have a story. You know, James Guthrie and I went out to the marketplace once together and had to fight off all these like rowdy boys. And I think you should pay him more. You know, you need to give him some back pay for all this job that he's doing. And they do, they give him a couple more dollars. And so, you know, which, you know, is whatever, you know, he ended up getting, you know, a little bit of success. And then even after insulting council, you know, the unchartered gentry, what he's really saying is you guys are running Pittsburgh, but Pittsburgh ain't much. Right. You know, you guys think you're so fancy. You think you can treat me that like this, but you're not very fancy. Even after this, they keep him on the job, and he remains the sort of go-to guy for policing for another couple of years until 1825. Now in 1826, they do finally hire the first regular salaried police officer in Pittsburgh, and it isn't him. You know, I don't know if he had it. By that point, he was pretty old. We know he had an adult son by 1816. So he probably was, you know, getting towards the end of his policing years by 1825. And they do hire the first full-time constable in 1826. And again, this is, so you really, it's a little complicated during this period because you have a guy who's running for constable, and who gets elected as constable. And then once you get the ward system, each ward is going to elect a constable. But these constables are sort of figureheads. They do some work, but they really don't come out for regular policing work. And then you start, council then starts to hire people who first by fee, and then ultimately with a salary, who are also called constable. So you sort of have formal constables who are sort of figureheads, and then you have working constables who are the people who come to be called police officers, right? And by 1926, you start paying somebody to be a regular police officer. In 1836, you get a formal night watch system, finally, after failing to do it in 1816, and that's going to have 16 night watch. They're going to be supervised by two lieutenants and by the first captain of the watch. So that's going to be a much more formal system of night policing. You'll notice the night watch is much bigger than the regular, you know, there's many more night watch people than there are constables, because again, that's when you really need the policing in this system. That's probably true today too. I don't know how they allocate their police today, but I imagine the night shift is very, very important, right? You know, even today. So So they do this, and they also importantly tell the constables that they're not allowed to collect fees. They have to rely on the regular salary. And that's because the constables, first of all, the night watch people, the night watch people tend to not be very, you know, good at their jobs, right? They tend to fall asleep. And part of that problem, and they also tend to be driven by wanting to collect fees instead of doing their regular job, which is supposed to be, you know, circulating through the neighborhood they're responsible for. They're supposed to call the hour. They're supposed to call the weather. And they're supposed to do this. The hours they're supposed to do that is between, it shifts a little bit over time, but basically from dark till day. So every day, the constable, the night watch is supposed to come out basically when it gets dark, a little bit after when it gets dark. And they're supposed to stay all night, every night, until it gets to be light again, right? And so they're actually working. The night watch is working, you know, more than 12 hours, right? And they're doing it like every day. So the night watch doesn't tend to be very good at their job. They tend to go to sleep during their shifts, which totally makes sense, right? And they tend to also want to take shelter because it's really cold. They tend to want to take shelter in their, you know, if they have these little stands, these guard stands, they tend to want to sort of stay there. They also tend to go into bars and drink, you know, during the time that they're supposed to be, just largely to stay warm probably. But they don't tend to be very good. And they also tend to be corrupt because they're not being paid very well. So they tend to accept money to do private tasks, right? So they're actually forbidden under the system to take fees. Okay. One of the big times when you're going to get an increase in the size of the force is going to be in 1851. It's going to get much bigger. By the time we get to 1861, the period that we're going to end with today, you're actually going to have 9 day constables. And they start to be called police officers right about this time. So your constables start being called police officers in 1857. So right at the beginning of the Civil War in Pittsburgh, they start to be referred to as police officers. You're going to have, I don't have the number of night watchmen at that time, but it's going to be more like in the 20s at that time. How much do they get paid? By the beginning of the Civil War, the police officers are getting paid $60 a month, and the watchmen are getting paid $1.75 per night. So the watchmen are paid a little bit less than the police officers, and they're paid in a different system. The number of police is basically largely going to increase over over this whole period. It increases gradually after 1836, but one of the biggest increases is with Major Guthrie in 1851. I just learned something about Mayor Guthrie, which is that his big claim to fame before before being mayor of Pittsburgh was that he was one of the guys overseeing the Trail of Tears. And I was like, no way. Oh. So he came to be our mayor. And then one of his big thing was to sort of, you know, build and increase the police force. Okay, so how are police armed? One more thing about how police are chosen, which is they're chosen very largely by political patronage. So during this time, that was, you know, being police officer was one of the jobs that the city officials, elected officials had the power to give out. And so basically they tended to give it out to their friends and give it out to people who'd been effective in supporting them in the past. So if you look at the names of the police officers, as I have, and you go through the, what you can find out about them in the newspapers, a lot of them have been active supporters of the political party in power. Right. And it's very common. This wasn't just Pittsburgh. This was kind of how policing worked. It certainly was true in like New York City, famously, or Boston. Mm-hmm. Right. This is how it's happening. But basically, in Chicago, that's what's going to happen. When a new mayor comes in, when you have an election for mayor, which is every year, they're going to have the capacity to fire all the police, right, and bring in new people. So policing during this time really isn't very stable. Now, there are some police, and you can see, who start having longevity and who start transcending. They start sort of being apolitical enough that they can transcend these shifts. Some people seem to be able to get along even with sort of mayors who don't agree with them politically. But generally speaking, policing is not a full-time career. It's not something that you would stay in for more than just a few years. You kind of come in maybe for 1 or 2 years in your 20s or 30s, and then you'd go off and do something else. Okay. And how much, let's see, how are they armed? They're not wearing uniforms. During this whole period, they're not wearing any uniforms. Some departments, and we'll see at the end, some departments are starting to wear police uniforms. By the 1850s in Britain, they're starting to wear police uniforms. We'll be talking about that. But in Pittsburgh, they're not wearing any uniforms. And Pittsburgh does issue badges for the police to wear, you know, in the 30s, for the police to wear on the outside of their clothing, so people know they're police. But the police actually don't like to put it visibly. They like to put it under their jacket so that people don't see it. Now, I don't have any explanation. I just have a complaint in the newspaper that the police are not keeping their badges visible. I don't know why, but I think it's because they don't want to be attacked. So we'll be getting to that. But so at this point, they're not wearing badges. And how are they armed? They have, anybody know, how would they be armed at this point?
Probably a nightstick.
Yeah, right. They have a nightstick. They can carry personal firearms. If they have a pistol, they can carry it. They're allowed to. But most of them don't have a gun. They have a stick that's like between 1 and 2 feet long, a wooden stick. At that time, it's actually called one of my favorite facts about policing. It's called a mace, right? It's called a mace. So later, when many, many, many years later, when a Pittsburgh company develops chemical mace, it's actually a replacement, right, of the old, you know, the police mace. But little known fact. Okay. Okay, so let's now get to who and what and who is being policed. And we're ready for the next one. I do have some real pictures coming up, but I didn't have pictures. We don't have pictures of policemen from this period. Yeah. Oh my God. That's such a good question. They hate each other because, and in fact, I have this great complaint. All of the day police write this like complaint about the night watchmen, and the night watchmen are trying to collect their fees. Like the night watchmen are trying to do things that would get some of the fees that the day policemen think belong to them. And so they write this long letter to council about how bad the night watchmen are and how they're just interested in getting the fees, and they don't do any of the regular policing stuff they're supposed to be doing. And the day policing are much better, police are much better and should be allowed to get all the fees. And so, and then the night watchmen actually do like clap back, and they're like, the day police are the worst, you know? So you do have a huge tension between these two bodies of men. And especially because the day police get paid more, and, you know, don't have to work like horrible hours, you know, though they do have to work every day, right? Like the night police. Yeah, that's a good question. But people also do move back and forth between the two. You can see people kind of starting on the night, starting with the night watch and kind of getting promoted into the day police. That definitely happens. Okay. So let's talk now about who they're actually policing. So what are they doing? And if you could actually scooch one more forward. There we go. Okay. Pickpocketing and street theft. Okay, so one thing during this period, banks are no good, right? You do not want to count. You do not want to, you'd be, you know, a fool at this point to keep your money in a bank, probably, right? You know, banks are not safe. They're always collapsing, especially, you know, in the 20s and 30s. They're collapsing all the time. They're not insured by anybody. There's no oversight, right? Anybody can open up a bank, and you just really can't keep your money in a bank. So most people carry all their money with them, right? Or they keep it in their house. They hide it in their house. Well, of course, you know, that really opens up theft, right? Theft is really, really lucrative during this time, much more than now. You know, when people really are, you get somebody's wallet, you can get a huge amount of money just because they have to walk around with it. So pickpocketing is a really huge deal and a very lucrative profession, can be during this time. So largely what the police are doing, one large part of what they're doing is dealing with pickpocketing and street theft. And here's just an image. This is not from Pittsburgh. This is New York, because we don't have images from this early because we're too small to be having illustrations in our newspapers. But pickpocketing and street theft. But then also burglary. You know, people definitely would burglarize people's homes. There's a lot of interest in getting good locks and, like, you know, things like that. But so police are often trying to deal with, you know, burglary or street theft. The police will, like, stop somebody if somebody's walking around with a bunch of merchandise or a bunch of, you know, items, and the police don't know why that person has that. They will stop that person and be like, why do you have, you know, this hat? You don't seem like a guy that would have a hat like this, you know, and you kind of figure out where this hat comes from. So the police are trying to sort of intervene and sort of like when people steal things. Okay, the next one. Okay, but most of what police do as today, about 90% of the work of police is order violations, right? Really what they want to do is keep the public areas free and clear and usable for everyone, right? Or maybe particularly certain voices who are more powerful in the community, right? But they want to make sure that nothing that is perceived as disorderly is occurring in the streets. And so that's largely going to be stopping people who are publicly drunk. And it's largely going to be policing teenage boys, right? Almost always police, you know, one of the big people that police have to deal with are teenage boys who are out on the street being rowdy. Apparently they're like, there's this great, I wish I had actually brought, I almost did, in the 1820s, there's this great article about like how the police need to be better, the constables need to be better at like controlling these teenage boys. By this, they mean like Guthrie specifically, right? You know, until like 25, but need to be better at controlling these teenage boys. They're like throwing firecrackers at women's feet, and they're like, they're even going to funeral processions and perching on tombstones and mocking the funeral processions. And they're out there on the river naked in the face of the sun, and they smell bad, and they use profanities, and they're just like absolutely the worst. And the police have to do something about this, right? So there's all sorts of like order violations. There's still domestic animals running around, and the police have to deal with the pigs and the horses. There's, as always, one of the big functions of the police, like right now, it's traffic, right? It's very largely what the police does. And at this time, it was people galloping their horses where they're not supposed to be galloping their horses, right? The police were responsible for, like, you know, reckless driving, right, of the horses and the carts, you know, and parking violations, leaving your cart somewhere where you shouldn't. So the police are doing the vast majority of what they're doing is this order violations. Okay, we're ready for the next. Oh, those guys, incidentally, if we go back, those guys, incidentally, are, again, New York, sorry, but they are, they're called Bowery Boys, and we would have our own version of that here, but that was kind of the thugs and the sort of ne'er-do-wells of this period. They had soap locks, they wore tight pants and top hats, and they would stand on the streets and whittle and harass women and just be thugs. And so that was largely they were being.
So I'm curious about the parenthetical mention of women as being disorderly here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, so the police are very largely policing men, right? The men are very much the objects of policing, except when they're driving out poor people, and that's often women. There's some prostitution that the police are dealing with, and, you know, driving out, you know, women who are abandoned women. but they're very largely dealing with men. Street harassment is a real issue. Men gathering on corners, particularly, or in front of churches, and which is just where there's like high, you know, populations of people walking by and just like mocking people or like, you know, harassing people is a real big issue. Or on bridges, that disorderly men would sort of gather on bridges, and then like as respectable people, and particularly women, went by, they would just like harass them and mock them. It's not cool. Okay. So, but the next one, fugitives from slavery. So slavery ends in Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania, basically at the time of the, right after the Revolution, but it ends gradually. We sort of time it out. So it takes a couple of years before all the enslaved people in Pittsburgh are no longer enslaved, but then also people from southern states will flee. We're right on the border with Virginia, right? So people would flee into Pittsburgh, and we had a lot of fugitive slaves in Pittsburgh. And one of the jobs of the police was always to capture fugitive slaves. They did a lot of that. And incidentally, I'm very proud to say that in general, slavery was very unpopular in Pittsburgh, largely because we thought the Southern whites who were slave owners were trying to bully us too, that they were trying to have too much power nationally. And so we tended to be sort of anti-slavery in Pittsburgh and tended to want to harbor fugitive slaves. So the police were often did help to take fugitive slaves, and they often actually got into big trouble with the rest of the community. Other people would sort of surround them and be like, you shouldn't help to retake this fugitive slave and things like that. But the police did often help to retake fugitive slaves on behalf of their Southern owners, or arguably sometimes people who weren't fugitive slaves, but who some Southerner claimed was a fugitive slave, right? So that was a big part of the job of the police during this period. Okay, ready for the next one? And then the last thing that the police did, and did quite a bit of, you know, Pittsburgh has a lot of strikes. And the first strikes we had were in the 1840s, we had strikes before that, but the first big strikes we had were in the 1840s and 1850s. And there were women's cotton mill strikes were the biggest ones. There were two women's cotton mill strikes in 45 and 48. But then there were also iron worker strikes. And so, and those were big deals. They got to be huge. And the police were sent out to suppress those strikes. And often the police got into huge armed fights with the workers who were striking, including with female workers. And one of the stories that really stands out for me is there is this, it's one of the textile strikes, and there's this woman, and she apparently has an axe. She's probably a teenager, right? And she has an axe, and she's trying to break open a chain with this axe so she can go in and attack the replacement workers, you know? And the police officer comes up and tries to take the axe from her, and her boyfriend attacks the police officer, like, you have to keep your hands off of her, you know? And the police officer ends up getting beat up pretty badly. But the, you know, it's one of the big jobs of police was to try to keep order, and particularly often intervening, you know, on behalf of the owners in these strikes. So and one of the reasons the police is increased so much during this period is that you sort of need, if you want to suppress these strikes, you sort of need, you know, a bunch of regular salaried people who can come together, you know, when they're called to suppress these strikes. So that is another of the important early functions of the police. And I think that's it for that. So I think we're ready for the next. Yes. But yes.
Go on first.
These are largely, yeah, they're in.
Yeah, the drawings we're seeing are very skilled. And I'm wondering, were they in a newspaper at that time or?
They would be, yeah, in the newspapers. I think that drawing was actually from the Lowell Mills. They had it wasn't a daily newspaper, but they had something called the Lowell Offering, which might have been like a weekly or a monthly or something like that. But yeah, it would have appeared, you know, and so the 1840s, you're going to have a huge technological leap forward with print technology. And so you're going to be able to start getting many more of these drawings, but we don't have it yet in Pittsburgh during this time. We can't find any images of kind of like regular people in Pittsburgh, but up in New England, around Boston and New York, they have the technology to print these drawings. Yeah. Okay. So uncertain authority. So part of the problem with the police is that they have, remind me, what time am I going for? Because I forgot to set my timer. To 10:45. So you want me to speak for like 10 more minutes? Is that right? Ideally it would be 10, right? Okay, I could do that. Okay, I'll have to speed up just a tiny bit. But basically, they have a problem then of authority. The problem of authority is, first of all, since they don't have any uniforms, they don't want to wear their badges. It's sort of hard to know, you know, who they are, even when they are the paid police. You know, somebody like Guthrie early on, you know, he certainly has a problem with authority. Like people know he's the guy that usually comes out when there's problems. But he really, as far as like having a status, you know, he's just kind of the guy who's willing to intervene, you know? And so it's really hard to sort of differentiate him from just other, you know, men in the community who are trying to tell you what to do. So there really is a problem with kind of establishing what the authority of the police is during this time. And people often, just like, you know, we talked about in the first session, we talked about how a lot of people resisted even legitimate authority. And this is definitely going to continue. It's very much the norm to resist arrest. And in fact, some people suggest that if you succumb to arrest, if you just agree to be arrested, you're sort of admitting guilt. So a lot of people felt that if you felt an arrest was wrongful, you were bound to resist that arrest, to sort of assert your dignity and your freedom and your rightfulness. So people very often did resist arrest. And I even have examples of, had a great story of a guy, and this was actually a Black man, who was arrested. I don't even know what he was arrested for. But he was arrested for some minor offense. And when the police arrest you at this time, like they don't put you in their police car, right? They have to walk you all the way back to the mayor's office. The mayor is the one who processes arrests at this time. So they have to arrest you, and they have to walk you all the way back to through the streets to the mayor's office. So if you're not willing to walk, first of all, that's going to be a problem. They're going to have to find other people to help them, or have to get other people around to, will you help me get this guy to the mayor's office, right? They might have to carry him. They sometimes do that. They might have to borrow a wheelbarrow and literally take them in wheelbarrows to the mayor's office. That was actually something that happened pretty frequently, right? They might have to like tie them up, right? They might have to bring somebody else out, you know, tie them up and then like bring somebody else out to like help get them to the, you know, so it's really actually hard to get through the streets. Plus, since there's so much resistance to authority at this time, if you're going through the streets, what if you see this guy's friend, right? Or what if you go by this guy's, as one police officer did, trying to bring somebody to the mayor's office, went by like this lodging house where this guy lived, right? And then all of his friends came out, right? And they freed him, right? So all the time people are trying to free themselves, resisting arrest, and all the time just people around are intervening to try to, if they think that the person is being wrongfully arrested. Police are getting beaten up a lot. Police get hit by rocks. Police just get beaten. Police get killed. Some police did die during this time in Pittsburgh, trying to do the work of policing. So you actually, there just wasn't very much deference at all to authority. It wasn't a culture of deference. Police often couldn't arrest people. There were some people who would actually say they were unarrestable. And what they meant was, I will not succumb to arrest. I will not agree to be arrested. And I have enough friends around me that they can fight anything that the police can bring out, right? A lot of people actually critiqued the police during this time, saying the police will only arrest people who are easy to arrest. You know, they're all about picking up drunks in gutters, right? But they won't confront the people who are actually violent, because it's too much work and they don't know if they can do it, right? So that was a big thing. So I think I have a couple of really good stories about arrests where even a police officer, attempts to arrest somebody in 1846, and the guy, his wife and his brother show up with guns. Well, first of all, he kind of holds off the police with a gun. The police also is armed. So the policeman's shooting into his house. He's shooting out at the police officer. His wife and his brother get armed and they come out and they're like, defending him against the police officer. And then all these like elites from the community, like the son of the owner of one of the big mills where this guy works, comes out and he's like, let me help. Let me intervene. And ultimately, this guy manages to get the guy to surrender and get him to the police station. And then the police arrest the son of the mill owner for not being sufficiently deferential to the police, right? So it ends up being this like big mess where nobody really understands who's in charge, and everybody's sort of trying to be in charge. It is pretty funny. Let's see. And there's also even competing police forces. If you could move forward one here. Yeah, there's Mayor Joseph Barker. He becomes mayor in 1850, and he's our only mayor that we've had so far who is arrested while incarcerated. He's a street preacher, and he is a big anti-Catholic. He's a huge bigot, anti-Catholic bigot. And he actually was arrested partially because he was out there harassing the Catholics on the street. And the administration prior to him was not anti-Catholic, and so had him arrested. And he gets elected from the jail, becomes our next mayor. They let him out so he could be mayor. And then he actually, none of the police will listen to him, and they won't disband when they tell him to disband. He's supposed to be able to basically set up the new police. And people just say, well, we're not going to let that happen because you're nuts. And so the police stay banded, and then he appoints a new police. And then there's two competing police in 1850, briefly, until everybody realizes he doesn't have any way to get money to pay his police. So his police end up, disbanding because they can't get paid, but not until the police have all been like arresting each other and arresting the council members, and like everybody's in jail and there's this total chaos. So there really is just kind of this crisis of authority with the police, which brings us finally to the end. Professionalization. And this is where I passed out the 1829 principles of policing. While all this chaos is going on in Pittsburgh, you have, and somebody was talking to me about Robert Peel. Robert Peel is setting up a new system of policing, which is going to be the basis of professional policing in the 1820s. And so the London Metropolitan Force is set up in the 1820s. And that's going to be very influential in the United States, though it's going to take a while to get to Pittsburgh. But the idea is that starts circulating, and we're reading about it all the time in Pittsburgh, is that the police ought to be engaged in preventative policing, that their job is to prevent crime. That the police should avoid violence where possible, And I have these principles of policing, which I won't read to you in because of time, but really some very, I think, sound principles of you know, what policing should look like. The Peel system is very much against fees, and it's all about people getting, you know, decent salaries. And it's about having proper oversight of the police, you know, and having standards of professional behavior on the part of police, and also not making them just political creatures so that they don't get moved out every year when there's a new election. So you can start having really permanent, you know, police who, you know, pick up a sort of set of professional skills. And that's what starts to happen. And gradually it begins to happen in Pittsburgh as well. Get the next slide. We don't get uniforms in Pittsburgh, police uniforms, and those are police. I know that looks like they're wearing fire hats. That's because police often help in cases of fire as well. But we don't get uniforms until after the Civil War in Pittsburgh. But we start to, you know, in many ways sort of embrace some of the professionalization, some of the elements of professionalization by doing things like having more oversight. You can see that the terms that our police officers are serving are longer, and some people are starting to serve as police officers for decades. You know, as you get towards the end of the antebellum period, you're getting longer careers and people who are picking up sets of skills, which is awesome. And then I have, now we don't have any pictures of actual Pittsburgh police officers from the period we're talking about. We don't have a single one that I can find. However, I've done something magical, I think. Okay, if you go one more. Okay, this is Captain William Reed. Captain William Reed is very important in the history of Pittsburgh policing because in the 1880s, he sits down and kind of works with the guy who writes the big history of the Pittsburgh police at that time. So he actually, and he has been a police officer since the 1840s by the time he writes this. Okay, so as an older man who has been a police officer for 40 years, he writes part of the history of the Pittsburgh police. So he used to be a young police officer during the time that we're talking about. He was actually in Allegheny, but we're going to count that as basically the same. So I did something. Do you guys know about these new apps where you can de-age somebody? So I had fun yesterday. If you could click one forward, Ted. See, there we go. We can imagine this is probably what Captain William Reed looked like in the 1840s. De-aged incidentally. I have the app. It's great. I've been like de-aging myself. I've been doing all sorts of things. So definitely recommend that app. Okay, well, let's stop here, and I'm open for any questions.
Thanks so much. Anybody online who wants to speak up, just feel free to unmute and pipe up, and here we go.
How much lighting evolved over this period of the night watch up to the 1860s?
You said lighting, street lighting?
Yeah, street lighting.
Yeah. So I should have mentioned that. You have all the right questions. One of the things that the police, that the early night watch did was light the lamps. And so they got paid per night, but then they also got paid for each lamp that they lit. So yes, lighting was super important, but then rowdy boys also would like be destroying the lights. That was one of the big.
These were gas lights or kerosene lights?
Oh gosh. I think it's too early for gas in the 1840s. I think they're just, I don't know though.
It's kerosene.
No, it may just be kerosene. I don't know. I should know the text. Well, there were hundreds of them. Yeah, because I looked at that because I was looking at the total pay of these night constables, and that actually really did increase their pay quite a bit. There were hundreds of these lights like by the 1840s. Yeah. So
how did lawyers fit into this picture back at that time?
How did
lawyers?
Oh, lawyers. There were so many lawyers. I'm really surprised how many lawyers there always were. So nobody would be represented at just like today in magistrate's court. It's unusual to have a lawyer if you go into like, well, maybe you know more about it than I do, but I think most people who go into the magistrate's district court today are not going to have a lawyer. You know, the vast majority of charges are things like, you know, order violations, you were drunk, whatever. They're small things. They're going to be fees. You're going to pay a fee. Often they actually, when you look at the outcome of this, they often drop it, you know, once you're brought in. The lawyers, I think, are going to come into play when you go to Court of Common Pleas. And, you know, that's at a higher level. So I like never come across lawyers in my story of street crime. They definitely exist. But I don't know much. I would love to know more about the history of criminal law, but I feel like lawyers don't become part of it until it's like a murder trial. Yeah. Yeah. No, you don't ever see, like, cause I'll read it. You know, my information is largely newspaper stories, right? But you never hear about a lawyer being involved in these smaller violations. Yeah, because I think people are poor, right? They're the people who are being, and I didn't talk about race, but largely who's being policed here are this is a small Black population of Pittsburgh, right? You know, teenagers, but largely poor people, you know, and they're not going to be hiring a lawyer. Yeah.
Anyone else? I have a question. These rowdy boys.
Yes.
Who are they? Are they like orphans? Are they people from poor families? Are they by and large, where do these rowdy boys come from? And are there any boys who aren't rowdy?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think it's hard to catch these rowdy boys. So sometimes it's hard to know who they are, but they're doing all sorts of things. They'll even, and we'll come across them later. I mean, they never go away. They're with us today. You know, they'll do things like, you know, in a little bit later than this, I want to say it's like the 1880s, they're like sledding provocatively by a police station. Like they're just like mocking the police, you know, by like sledding illegally somehow, right, by their police station. And like, you know, they're totally, no, so I, you know, and it's after school. That's what, you know, this particular article.
So they go to school.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This particular article was like after school, they're everywhere. They're like all over the streets smelling and like, you know, being awful. And so I think these are boys of good family, or not good family, but just like regular boys. And the article I was reading was saying, we need more policing to agree with, to deal with this. But it was also saying, parents, where are you? You know, why aren't you dealing with this? But I do think that during this time, it was very common for kids to just, you know, stay out until, especially, you know, older kids to just stay out until it was time for dinner, right? Come back for dinner. And even little kids during this time, like all the time, you know, kids are being run over by horses, you know, things like that. But like little kids in ways that like indicates that they just kind of ran wild, right? I think that during this time, parents had less bandwidth, you know, they were dealing with like basic survival. They maybe had a lot of kids, you know, women had a lot of kids at home. And so kids tended to just go out onto the streets, you know, where they could be like run over by a pig, you know, or, you know, all sorts of horrible things happen to kids, you know, they'd fall into vats of whatever, you know, and you're like, or like, they'll be like, you know, fall into the fire, you know, and it's just like the, you know, there was much more lax parenting, I think, in the 19th century than you're going to have later.
That may not have been true later. I'm fifth of six kids and we never went inside the house until dinner time. And we were always out in the street, well, the neighborhood. And so I could easily picture it, you know, from my own experience. And like you said, the bandwidth thing and survival and just getting food on the table, you can imagine easily.
Yeah.
I can remember stories from my father that would go back to the early 1900s of gentlemen carried a gun. And they would, they used to talk about an area in Dayton where he said on Friday night, you could go down there and say, I'm looking for a fight. And five fights would start to see who got to fight you. It was just the way it was.
I mean, it was a much more violent time. And I think that is one thing to kind of realize is that, you know, I think some people say that it's in the 1840s, some historians have argued that it's in the 1840s that we start really getting more sensitive about witnessing other people's pain. We start doing things like, and even like we start things like preventing the, you know, the society prevent cruelty to animals, you know, starts at this moment, like in the 1840s, but things like moving your roast, you know, with like, you'd have like a pig head, you know, whatever, moving it onto a sideboard and off of your table, but things like giving morphine, you know, the invention of sort of like painkillers and the use of those when people are in pain or dying, you know, and just in general, moving executions into private spaces or behind walls. In general, people start to get more sensitive about the pain of others during the 1840s, they say, which I think is true. You know, but I would say that there was just a lot of violence. It was very common to get, you know, get beaten up, right? It was a much more common experience.
You mentioned early on that was there any codification or laws at this point or formal court systems? You said early on the families would get together and resolve these things, but by the 1860s or 1850s or 40s, were there certain levels of crimes that actually there was a court system and were the police involved in bringing those people in? And
yeah, definitely. So the mayor at first, so you start having a mayor and the mayor runs his own court. The mayor, you start having a mayor in 1816, and he's almost like the head of the police is his first job. And he actually runs the court with the help of some other, let's say aldermen, who are basically magistrates. And they have the legal power to decide court cases and put people in the jail. Right. Yeah. And there's always magistrates, right? The magistrates came in with the country, right? You know, so there's always magistrates. The laws are definitely codified. Now, do the magistrates always know what the laws are? They have little handbooks, right, that they can buy. There's one that's called Binns Justice that they often buy in Pittsburgh, which is it's the Pennsylvania law. So they definitely do have these law books. And if you want to appeal anything from the magistrate's court or from the mayor's court, you can go up to the court of quarter sessions, or basically the court of common pleas. There's also a Supreme Court to the state, you know, from the very beginning. And so there is an appellate process that you can work your way up. And then there's a court for serious charges. There's a court that might involve the death penalty. There's the court of oyez and termine, which again is present from the very beginning. There's this, you know, court of oyez and termine, which is much more like formalized even than these other courts. So.
This is more a point of curiosity, but you know, I was a practicing lawyer. I'm retired, but I have tried cases in district justice courts, magistrates who were not lawyers and really didn't know the law.
Yeah.
Yeah. So interesting.
You have hit on something I care about very deeply. Yes, I care about very deeply having magistrates that are lawyers. But yeah, no, it was definitely the case that many of these people who were magistrates did not know the law. And really what they would do is enforce local norms of justice. And this wasn't just in Pittsburgh. I did a lot of work down in the southern courts at this time. And they would have like, this person's in jail for, rumor mongering or something. And then like you'd look in the law book and there was no such charge. Like that wasn't illegal. It was not illegal to rumor monger, you know, but this person's in jail for rumor mongering because that's what the magistrate did. Yeah.
One of the magistrates or district justices was a funeral director just making some extra bucks.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, it's actually really fascinating. I think we might've talked about this before, but you could be like today there's constables, just like there were, you know, the constable system earlier that was fee driven. If you want to run for constable in the next election, you totally can, right? You can run for constable. Usually there's nobody running. Usually nobody does run. But if you do run, you have the right to collect fees. You'd have to arm yourself. You'd have to get your own gun. They don't pay for your gun. You can buy a car with a cage in it. And that's what some constables do. And then you could be the constable. And then you actually have the right to transport prisoners, and you have the right to kind of work with the magistrate district judge. But it's still a very informal system. And it's like, it's very much just the continuing system from the early days, which has stayed on the books, even, you know, with the rise of modern policing.
Anyone online with a question? If not, I'll just say thank you very much. We're looking forward to week 3.
Thank you. thank you. Yeah, these are wrong.